I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I'll blow back out again. I guess you've heard about every kind of blues. I guess you've heard about every kind of blues. But when the dust gets high, you can't even see the sky. I've seen the dust so black that I couldn't see a thing. I've seen the dust so black that I couldn't see a thing. And the wind so cold, boy, nearly cut your water off. I seen the wind so high that it blowed my fences down. I seen the wind so high that it blowed my fences down. Buried my tractor 6 feet underground. Well, it turned my farm into a pile of sand. Yes, it turned my farm into a pile of sand. I had to hit that road with a bundle in my hand. I spent 10 years down in that old dust bowl. I spent 10 years down in that old dust bowl. When you get that dust pneumonia, boy, it's time to go. I had a gal and she was young and sweet. I had a gal and she was young and sweet. But a dust storm buried her 1,600 feet. She was a good gal, long, tall, and stout. Yes, she was a good gal, long, tall, and stout. I had to get a steam shovel just to dig my darling out. These dusty blues are the dustiest ones I know. These dusty blues are the dustiest ones I know. Buried head over heels in the black old dust. I had to pack up and go. And it just blowed in. And I'll soon blow out again.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker on May the 28th, 2014, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. And you're running out of days in May to get it done. It's the 28th. You don't have very long to do it. So if you're going to do it, you better do it if you're ever going to do it in May, because it'll never have this same date again. I'll tell you that. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And our big website is resist.com. And any way you want to contribute to helping with the website, just contact merchandiseresist@yahoo.com, and we'll see where you can fit in. Don't forget our bunker number now. It's 574-267-5036. And if you had problems getting through to it, I just discovered, luckily, one of our compadres emailed me and told me it was ringing busy, and I thought it's not that busy. So I checked, and the cable pulled out of the phone, so I'm not sure how many days it's been out. So anyhow, it's back in there, and there's a message on there, and also you can leave your message. And if I'm around here, I'll pick up the phone. Well, it looks like old Woody Guthrie's times are coming around again. We got 7 states that are extremely bad off for water. California got maybe 2 years at this rate of water left. Like I said yesterday, you better start making your plans. We may have another Dust Bowl coming too, out there in Kansas and Oklahoma and all that. Remember that Dust Bowl got so bad that in Washington, D.C., they couldn't see the sun. That gives you an idea how bad Dust Bowl can get. There's going to be a lot of Dust Bowls around this old earth coming up. Lack of water. Wasting water. Wasting water. We waste a hell of a lot in this country on agribusiness. Agriculture, it's not going to be feeding the American people at all. It's going out of the country, shipped out of the country. So we don't need this much agriculture in this country to feed our population. So they're ruining the ground. They're spraying it with Roundup and every other goddamn toxic chemical. I saw them doing it about a quarter of a mile from me. They had a big field the other day. They had those great big fiberglass barrels on the back of their tractor. They were spraying that shit all over. I may go up there and get a little piece of that dirt, take it down to the lab and see what they say about it. But I'm glad at least I'm separated by a quarter of a mile from that crap. But we've been ruining the earth for a long time, like they did down south, overplanting cotton. That's another byproduct of having cheap nigger labor. It was overplanting of cotton and ruining the land. A lot of that land is never recovered. Well, I see they're getting ready to start the Olympics down south. And the people are rioting in the streets, and they should be rioting in the streets. This is all just turned into another capitalist ploy, just another capitalist promotion. Billions of dollars spent on these zoo operations instead of having just simple competition on the local level. For all the talk of global honor and prestige that the Olympics brings to a host city, talk largely promoted by the International Olympics Committee itself and their bought off. We know that, I think it was Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry was involved in that stuff. And he raked off a whole lot of money. I believe when he was involved in the Olympics in Utah, if I'm not mistaken. The truth is that the games tend to smother cities in debt, saddle them with venues they can ever use again. The 2022 Winter Olympics are the next games to be awarded. And as it turns out, city after city is declining the honor of hosting them. Residents of Krakow, Poland overwhelmingly rejected the idea of hosting the 2022 games. Leading city officials withdraw Krakow's bid on Monday. This follows Stockholm, Sweden's leaders' decision to withdraw. Munich, Germany's voters rejected rejection of an Olympic chase, and the Davos St. Moritz, Switzerland defeat of a referendum on hosting the games. For those keeping the count, that's four of an original eight host cities which had considered hosting the games. Two more city bids, while not technically dead, may as well be. Lviv, Ukraine is having real military issues and can't afford to waste time thinking about the Olympics. They're busy buying ammo. While Oslo, Norway's bid, is floundering politically. Why the sudden mass exodus from hosting? Because cities with an eye for financial reality have seen the results. Russia spent $51 billion on the Sochi Olympics, an incomprehensible sum for any nation, but particularly one teetering on the edge of political turmoil. China spent $40 billion for the 2008 Beijing Games. Montreal lost nearly $1 billion hosting the 1976 Games, and it took 30 years to pay off that debt. Nagano, Japan, which hosted the Olympics in 1998, apparently still hasn't paid off its debt. It's no surprise, then, that the only two cities seriously still in the running for the 2022 Winter Games are Almaty, Kazakhstan, and Beijing, China. Two locals where the people don't get a choice in whether the games come or not. The Olympics themselves aren't the problem. The games give us some each year, fine sporting moments every time they come around. The problem is the naked greed and capitalism that slithers in the games' wake like everything else. Every area. The demands of that host cities do more and more and more to make each game more spectacular than the last. It's never-ending game of no-limit poker. And the IOC is happily watching as the stakes skyrocket every 2 years. Want to play? Go right ahead. Cities of the world, your grandchildren will be just fine with paying it off, right? That's sent to us by one of our good supporters out there. Well, there you go. They're using Olympics much like they use occupational war now to make money. It's all based on capitalistic greed, every bit of it. And if they try to tell you it isn't, they're lying sons of bitches. Well, let's go back several years, quite a while back, before all these people got killed in World War II. Back where I think, in fact, I know National Socialism got off the track. And this is Gregor Strasser speaking. We are socialists, enemies, mortal enemies of the present capitalist economic system with its exploitation of the economically weak, with its injustice in wages, with its immoral evaluation of individuals according to wealth, and money instead of responsibility and achievement, and we are determined under all circumstances to abolish this system. And with my inclination to practical action, it seems obvious to me that we have to put a better, more just, more moral system in place, one which, as it were, has arms and legs and better arms and legs than the present one. Unquote. That's from Gregor Strasser, Thoughts About the Tasks of the Future. Well, that sounds a lot different than invading Poland and advancing mechanized warfare. Sounds to me like cleaning up your situation in your own country and replacing the capitalist system with a functioning system that includes the working class. You don't have to call it socialist. You could call it many names. But because there's definitely some bad socialists out there too. But what happened to Gregor Strasser? Murdered during the Night of the Long Knives along with about 1,700 faithful party members. And that was the deal that Hitler made with the economic elite in Germany, the industrialists, that he could keep his SS, but he had to get rid of his brown shirts and anybody else that went along with that. I wonder how many of you people really want to have allegiance to somebody that would, you know, you'd work your ass off and suffered and died in the streets to bring them to the pinnacle of power, and then they kill you? I know one guy that's just amoral enough in this movement to do that, if he ever got the chance. But I'm not going to talk about him because he's pretty much out of the picture except in his own mind. But anyhow, you should read more of what the Strasser brothers were talking about and ask yourself, would you really want to worship a leader that goes in the middle of the night and kills his most trusted people, and not just a few that he might claim or this or that or homosexual or whatever, but 1,700 people, including women. And then we got into the Drew Harvest, right? Mechanized war. Vast warfare. You always know when you've lost when you start wars. When you start a war, you've lost. You've lost before you've even started. So until you get that through your head and know that if war is coming around, the bad guys are in control. Because Germany didn't need to have a war. They're going to solve their problems peacefully, internally. And if anybody would have attacked Germany from the outside, most of the Western world would have sided with Germany at that time. So anyhow, think about it. Because we've got the same, well, not the same, but similar situation now with these dirty, filthy capitalists under cover of Republican politics and politics in general doing the same thing to us they've done to Europe. Think about it. Think about what Gregor Strasser said. One of our she-wolves said, this is a song we ought to play over Terrible Tommy's Tavern sometime. I think we played it one time, but let's play it right now. Take a little break here. How about it? And that was for that she-wolf out there that contributed that song. Yeah, we like that over at the tavern. You know, we work hard and then we play hard around here. Yeah, we don't mess around. When we do something, we really do it. Well, are you all ready for this Syrian expedition? They'll be pulling troops out of Afghanistan after an inglorious defeat, which anybody with a brain knew that could never be won. You never could nation build. Whatever those people want, they're going to have. The Taliban's going to have it all back in a couple of years anyhow. But now Obama says, I think we better go down there and help out those rebels in Syria. Yeah, we got to get involved in that. We need to get a few more of these white boys killed, you know. There are too many white boys around.
Law is more than the policeman on the corner. More than the courthouse where our laws are enforced. More than the jail where lawbreakers are punished. In your whole community, there are customs and moral codes which guide your actions. What social controls affect you?
So now we have this bizarre, weird, secret power. Trial judge doesn't have to tell you about it, then I sure can.
The risk is people get away with murder.
I'm Shannon Heffernan, and this is Life of the Law.
I'm going to go in as this undercover brother, and I'm going to make a difference from the inside.
But as a prosecutor, Butler had to put a lot of people behind bars.
And it turned out that I was kind of good at that. You know, that was like this, you know, this clean-cut black guy, and most of the jurors in D.C. were black, and they would just beam at me when I said, my name's Paul Butler, I represent the government. They'd almost do whatever I wanted.
Almost. Except when it came to petty drug cases. Even when it was very clear someone was guilty, juries came back with an innocent verdict. Butler was confused. Why would they let someone they knew was guilty of a drug charge go free? Then, one day, he's prosecuting one of these cases.
And the defense was something like, well, yeah, the police caught me with the drugs, but they weren't mine. And you know, I was like, okay. You know, for the law, it actually doesn't matter. If the drugs are on you, it's what's called a strict liability crime. So you're guilty. So the judge told that to the jurors. Jury went out, they deliberated, and they came back with a big fat not guilty. I was like, oh my God, what's up? So I was right out there outside the jury, the room where they come out. And none of the black jurors would talk to me. And the white woman stopped for a moment. And I said, what happened? And she said, we all knew he was guilty, but he's so young.
Even if the jurors thought the boy was too young, the law was still the law. Butler asked the more experienced prosecutors what was going on. It turned out it had a name, jury nullification. When a jury nullifies, it finds a defendant innocent, although the jurors may actually believe he's guilty. And because it's illegal to retry someone, the person goes free. The prosecutors Butler talked to hated it. They thought it weakened the legal system. But nullification has played a big role in American history. Jurors used it all the way back during the Revolutionary War to free Americans who spoke out against the British, and during Prohibition to keep bootleggers out of jail. Most famously, it was used during slavery.
Imagine you were a juror in 1850, and it was against the law to help a slave run away. And so jurors would often say, not guilty, even though these folks were 100% guilty. And by the way, those jurors also helped create the conditions that led to the abolition of slavery. And I ask folks now, well, what would you do?
It seems like an easy answer. Slavery is wrong. Jury nullification has a dark side, too.
I don't think anyone could really advocate for a system where the juries can do whatever they want to do.
Jeff Kramer is a managing director of Kroll Investigations and has tried at least 100 jury trials. Kramer says juries have used nullification to do things we look back on as being right, but they've also used nullification to do things that were really wrong.
Butler was so badly standing that we couldn't hardly just tell who he was, but he happened to have on a ring with his initials.
In August of 1955, two white men killed Emmett Till, a black 14-year-old who they said whistled at a white woman.
We never have any trouble until some of our southern niggas go up north and the NAACP talks to them and they come back home. I'd like for the NAACP to know that we are here giving all parties a fair and impartial trial.
The trial was not fair. The evidence was clear. Later, the two white defendants would even admit to the murder. But the all-white jury found the white defendants innocent. That was nullification, too. Again, Jeff Kramer.
The risk is people get away with murder. And they get away with murder because the jury in those cases regarded the defendants as more valuable than the victims. So if we allowed jury nullification, system's over. It doesn't work. It's broken.
There is nobody who will tell you that the jurors are anything but serious and impressed with the magnitude of the task that they've been given. Sherry Diamond is a professor at Northwestern Law School. Jury deliberation is usually very private, but Diamond received rare permission to study them in action. Her conclusion? Nullification doesn't happen often.
The jurors will say, boy, I sure don't agree with that law, but we have no choice.
Of course, juries are a cross-section of society with all its flaws. But Diamond says you have to remember that in order to be on a jury, you have to first get through the selection process. That weeds out people with biases, people who might nullify.
So the jury is us, but perhaps a better us.
That better us will nullify in rare circumstances, usually when our accepted morals don't match the letter of the law.
One way of saying it is that this is a kind of safety valve for the system, and we tolerate it. And there are, in fact, court opinions that say specifically that the jury has no right to do it. But, of course, we structurally build a system in which the jury has the power to do it.
Jury nullification dates all the way back to common law. It was designed as a check and balance on the government's power. Paul Butler, the prosecutor who was having trouble getting guilty verdicts, thinks it may be the most direct form of democracy we have. 12 people in a room charged with coming to a single conclusion. He left the prosecutor's office and became a professor at George Washington University. He now believes those jurors who nullified in all those drug cases were onto something.
There are more blacks who are under criminal justice supervision now than there were slaves in 1850.
Butler thinks drug laws are to blame for those high incarceration numbers. Statistically, there are less black drug users, but more blacks in prison for drugs. So just like jurors nullified the fugitive slave laws, Butler thinks modern jurors should nullify drug laws.
Sometimes the law really is unfair, and sometimes jurors really should say that people are not guilty, even if they committed the crime, especially if it's a drug case, because the drug laws are selectively enforced, and I don't think it's fair.
Now, despite the role nullification can play, chances are you haven't heard of it, and there's a reason for that. Most people in the legal system think juries shouldn't nullify. It's too dangerous. Still, they can't take away jurors' ability to nullify without taking away other basic rights enshrined in the Constitution. But there are three ways the legal system tries to discourage nullification. First, as a juror, you take an oath.
Do each of you solemnly swear that you will render a true verdict according to the law and the evidence, so help you God?
Second, defense lawyers cannot tell jurors to nullify. They can only raise doubts that their client didn't commit the crime.
Members of the jury, these are the facts. And I am confident today you will see this case is full of reasonable doubts.
Third, most judges basically tell you not to nullify.
It is your responsibility to decide what the facts of this case may be and to apply the law to those facts.
So, juries may be able to nullify, but the system is set up to hide that.
So now we have this bizarre, weird, secret power that one of my functions is, if the trial judge doesn't have to tell you about it, then I sure can.
Butler tries to spread the word about nullification through speaking and writing. Another activist takes a more direct approach.
I'm Julian Heiklin, and I am the biggest pain in the ass in the world.
Heiklin is a member of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Their goal is to make sure jurors know they can nullify. Heiklin stands outside courtrooms, handing out literature and talking to people. He thinks nullification is a good strategy for all kinds of laws he sees as being unfair, including gun laws. In August of 2011, the U.S. government charged Heiklin with jury tampering, a serious offense. The case got a lot of attention, especially when the judge denied Heiklin a jury trial. After all, it would be just another opportunity for him to tell jurors how to nullify. But if the courts want to keep this jury nullification thing on the down low, then Heiklin says the joke has been on them.
So they've made a national issue out of this. They've done something that I could have never done by myself. This is all over the country. All of a sudden, I've become a major public figure, and I'm just a shabby old man with a few ridiculous pamphlets.
They're handing out the biggest pamphlet ever.
Of course, they're handing out the biggest pamphlet ever.
Since I spoke with Heiklin, the case has been dropped. He plans to be outside courtrooms again soon, for better or worse, making the secret power of nullification a little less secret.
Well, there you go. As a lone wolf, that's the best law school education you're going to get, because jury nullification is a great revolutionary act. And it was written about quite a bit by Lysander Spooner back in the 1800s. He became very famous, and you can look up Lysander Spooner's booklet and probably get it downloaded in PDF. But basically, that's what it's saying. Now, the only problem is, the really good thing about it is you don't have to have jury nullification if you know exactly what you want to do, especially to protect yourself not being charged with jury tampering. Because getting cohesion among white people today, or anybody today, is almost impossible. And trust 12 people to come up with the same decision. You see, the balance of power is in the hands of the judges and the prosecutor. So they make it sound like, oh no. But the power is in their hands. So you need every defense you can get in court. We tell you all the time not to talk, period. Unless it's with your attorney, and check out your attorney too. But if a person's up on a felony or a criminal case like that, it only takes one person to hang the jury and vote no. One person. And many times, if there's a hung jury, they won't come back to the DA and retry the case because it costs too much. Much of what happens in the courts is because it costs too much. Except when it's a white racist, of course, then it's they'll spend any amount of money they can. You see, that a lot of you people don't understand that. If it was an old Klansman from down south, they'll spend a fortune. They'll spend decades going after him, you see. They only have so much money, especially in the state and the local coffers, to do this. Federal coffers, they don't give a shit. They'll spend any amount of money to get you. But when you go in there, if you see a high-profile case and you can get on that jury and it's somebody you like, or even somebody you want to see an honest judgment, you know, like me, I was chosen to be on a jury years ago out in California. And I made it all the way to the end. When the judge asked me about my impartiality and all that kind of stuff, I said, I will judge the law and the facts in the case. And they immediately threw me out, because what that meant was I was judging whether the law was just and right. And they don't want anybody on the jury doing that. Now, I'll go so far as this. If I was on a jury and there was a black street person that was charged with drugs, marijuana, you know, and stuff like that being charged, I'd vote not guilty. You know, he's no threat to me. But the more you give the state the power in these courts, and the more they win, the more unjust they get. But if we could be a homogeneous group like they were more down south in the old days, you could get a jury nullification like O.J. Simpson got downtown L.A. But here again, you've got to watch it, because you can't go to other juries and get them involved in a conspiracy, which is jury tampering. So it's mainly safe for a lone wolf who's not known to get on a jury and just decide not guilty, period. And don't let anybody talk you out of it. Anyhow, that's your lesson on the law for today. I call it guerrilla warfare. guerrilla lawfare. Remember how much power the juries have. Juries, if they recognize their power, that's what Lysander Spooner was trying to say. They have total power if they'll use it. But they're intimidated by prosecutors and these damn judges. They sit up there in their black crow uniform and sit up high and, you can't do this and you can't do that, when a jury can do pretty much what they want to. Well, let's bring a rogue progressive on here and see what he thinks about Memorial Day. Seems as if he thinks about the same thing about it I do. How about that?
Dream of me. Like I dream of you, in a place that's warm and dark.
21 past the hour.
In a place where...
Yeah, I don't. There are a number of reasons I don't like Memorial Day, primarily because it's just so sad. And I think that's the main reason it is so sad. And it's a kind of sadness that really is unnecessary when you think about where we have, where the United States has ordered people to go to kill or be killed over the past century. Very little of it makes any sense at all. I mean, it doesn't. I don't think the Vietnamese were ready to invade the United States or drop bombs on us, or I know the people in Iraq weren't planning on doing that, the leadership, or certainly not Afghanistan. It's vile. I watched the placing of the wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns this morning, with the military and the president and the prayers and the precise military ceremonies involved. And it makes for heart-pulling video. And I guess you'd have to be a real son of a bitch not to feel at least a fleeting bit of pain and sympathy for the families who lost fathers and sons and brothers and uncles. And of course, now it's mothers and sisters, and all that is so hideously tragic and sad. You know, the general, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who spoke of that ceremony, said too many times people do not listen to the third or fourth verse of America the Beautiful, where it talks about alabaster cities. And what they're talking about, my interpretation, are those white gravestones that just flow, hundreds of thousands of them, in not just Arlington National Cemetery, but all the national cemeteries around the country. And, but there was the general, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and all his... radiant splendor, with all the accoutrement of a military chief. His uniform was absolutely resplendent, the gold and the soup on his chest. What do you call that, hash now? I don't know. And I didn't hear Obama speak. I just didn't want to. But I did watch that little bit. And, of course, the playing of taps at the Tomb of the Unknowns by a military bugler, that's always, extremely sad. But, I think about, and I'm sure a lot of people do, I think about the people who gave a family member to go die in some godforsaken foreign country. And they're usually godforsaken after we have had our way with these countries, after we bomb and shock and awe them, or nuke them, or what have you, or invade them, or occupy them. And by the time the troops arrive, there is resistance, of course, as there would be in this country. The populations of those countries that we invade, where we send our military, are going to resist. They're not just going to throw their hands up in the air, are they, and say, oh, here come the American soldiers that represent the American death machine. Let's everybody just stop and throw our hands up or lay down. No, they resist. And when they resist the countries that we invade, those countries either become non-operating states like Iraq, or we leave in defeat. And all that death and destruction was for what? For the Vietnamese, all that death and destruction was to defend and protect their homeland. That's all they were doing. They were protecting and defending their homeland. They did it against the Chinese. They did it against the Japanese. They did it against the French. And by God, they did it against the Americans. So I just, you know, I watched the circumstance, and the pomp and circumstance, I should say. And I just wonder, what the hell is going on here? When we come back, I'll have one person's interpretation of it. Stay with us.
Thanks, Mr. Rogue Progressive. Right on the button. Right on the button. Well, I received a nice note from an educator in Japan who I've been in contact with. And as you know, I've been to Japan a couple of times. And here's the note. How are you? I was just reading the academic article on white activists the other day and was surprised to see your name mentioned in there. You were mentioned in a context in which an effective leader makes members feel needed and valued, as well as building a high level of loyalty among them. Being proud, I just wanted to share this with you. Have a wonderful day, Mr. Metzger. Well, thank you from the country of the rising sun. I wish as many white Americans were as racist as the Japanese nationalists I met in Japan. We'd be in a lot better shape. Well, that great state of Florida with that crooked criminal governor down there who should be in prison himself. Oh, this court down there came up with a real doozy. Florida cannot use a hard cutoff on a victim or a convict's IQ as the sole basis for determining eligibility for execution. A divided U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Tuesday. The 5-4 decision favored a Florida death row inmate whose supporters say is intellectually disabled. The court struck down the state's requirement that a baseline threshold IQ score of 70 must be established before a capital prisoner can present additional evidence supporting claims of a disability. Well, there's a hell of a large percentage of the black race of the black killers are going to be released under that. They can't hit, if they hit 70 IQ, they're going to have to let them off. At issue was how states may define mental retardation within the context of inexact IQ test when determining whether convicted murderers deserve capital punishment. The High Court in 2002 banned execution for those who were determined to be suffering from what was then labeled mental retardation. Here again, a large percentage of the black race would fit that, but the court left it to the states to establish standards of measurements. You know, in every case, they get around to giving many, many blacks a get-out-of-jail card. At the same time, they're stuffing more and more in jail for small things like too much marijuana in their pocket. It's insane. This whole legal system is insane. So you got a guy who he goes out and kills a whole family of white people or black people or whoever. But if he's got an IQ of 70, if he's lower than 70, he's protected. There you go. Wow. Well, I snuck in here and got a little bit of this lecture here. Let's hear this about the Civil War.
In 1861, it is not uncommon to be, you know, conceived, born, schooled, married, work, raise your own family, die, and be buried within 50 miles of the same spot. The idea, for young 20-something men of going on some grand adventure, which the many recruiting posters tried to play up that aspect of the war, was something that was appealing. This might be your only chance to get away from home and see a little bit more of the world. So adventure would certainly be one reason. Let's get some other ones. Yeah, Zach.
I think a lot of it is just the concept of patriotism. You know, they wanted to fight and save the Union.
Okay.
More the Confederacy, depending on which side they fought on.
Patriotism or ideology. I mean, this is one of the quintessential ideological wars. for the North, there is initially the desire to restore the Union.
Yeah.
And the rebellion. In the latter years of the war, for many Union soldiers, it also becomes a war of emancipation. For the South, there is a sense of defending their Southern way of life, a Southern society that's built on the foundation of racial chattel slavery. These are wars in which, you know, there are important patriotic and ideological motivations to get out and join the Army. It's interesting, when I give this lecture, how quickly people bring up patriotism and ideology. Sometimes people leave it way to the last, very end. Those are the cynical classes. You guys are not cynical. You're putting it right at the top, which I like. Okay, so we've got desire for glory. We've got adventure. What are some other reasons?
Same line as patriotism, but honor.
Okay.
South, especially.
Well, South and North. Remember, one of the things that shows up a lot in these posters, if you're looking for to close read the text, you know, able-bodied men, able-bodied men, free men, brave men, courageous men needed to come. And this idea of honor, and particularly kind of masculine honor. I mentioned earlier in the class that particularly in the South, many, many young men went, voluntarily and flooded the recruiting stations in the first weeks of the war. But there were a few that were a little reluctant, maybe didn't could see a little bit into the future and imagine that military service was not their cup of tea. And it was not unusual for those young men to get a package from a sweetheart in the mail that had, you know, a very lacy, frilly lady's undergarment in it. Not, you know, as a sexual overture, but to send a very clear message. If you are not going to join the Army, you should probably get used to the idea of wearing this around.
I wasn't able to play this for you because they wouldn't allow it off YouTube. There's been a major invasion into Spain by illegals. I mean, it showed one picture, but they didn't. We didn't get the rest of the video. Massive numbers of these people from North Africa invading Spain. Shades of the book Camp of the Saints. If you've never read it, pick it up. Camp of the Saints. Well, let's check in on old Max Kaiser, our old financial buddy here, and see what he's got to say. He's always got something to say.
Max Kaiser, if wishes were Kanishas, we'd all be fat. If wishes were oil reserves, we'd all be fat cheeks. If wishes were stacks of money to launder, we'd all be London-dwelling fat cats. Stacy?
Max, we have many wishes and many commissions in our headlines today. The first headline, David Clark, villains choose safe London to launder their dirty money. So David Clark is a former fraud investigator with the Metropolitan Police. And he goes over some of the ways that they do it, including buying multi-million pound houses here in London, driving up the prices and the cost for everybody. But he says the phony nightclub set up the type of business that takes a lot of cash. Nightclubs, cafes, and restaurants are favorites. Even if the place is empty, you can still claim to be pulling in thousands of pounds, which you can put into the company bank account. A victimless crime? Not if you're the legitimate club or eatery owner next door trying to compete against a rival who doesn't need to make a profit.
I know. As I've said before, you know, London is the global headquarters for global financial fraud. This is the front line in the fight against financial terrorism. And this is my Vietnam, in other words. These are I'm knee-deep in the mud of fraud here in London. and I'm fighting, you know, Charlie, in this case, the cocaine-sniffing bankers in London who are perpetrating these massive frauds and destabilizing the global economy and committing acts of brazen financial terrorism. But that's the job I've been given to do, and by golly, I will continue to do it.
Well, it's also, you know, the government claims they're trying to help people find jobs and grow the economy so that you can find a job. And yet the fact is that not only do you have money launderers running operations that they don't care to turn a profit and then can put out genuine companies out of business where they do need to turn a profit, but you also have the case of like GRG, the Global Restructuring Group, part of RBS, the taxpayer-owned bank, that is also doing the same thing, putting companies out of business intentionally as well. So whether it's unintentional or intentional, we just have a wishful thinking that there will ever be jobs returning to this sort of economy.
Right. It's like HSBC Now or Barclays Now instead of Apocalypse Now. You know, this is going up the river with Martin Sheen to meet Colonel Kurtz. In this case, that would be George Osborne, who sits on a mountain of skulls from the austerity victims that he's been able to extract the last dying breath and transmit via securitization into yet another bonus for his fat cat friends while he gorges himself sick on piggy footing pudding. What kind of pudding they eat around here? Everything. Why are all these puddings named such odd names like spotted or something like that? It seems everything's very babyish around here. They wear their wellies and their brawlies, and it's all very infantile because they ought to be suckling on the queen. You know, you've got to get real jobs with real people and not let these financial terrorists like Osborne, you know, tell you what to do all day, y'all.
So we have the phony nightclubs used to launder money. Now we have a hoax energy policy in America using phony numbers. Now we have a huge story coming up about the shale oil reserves, but first I want to go back to this headline from February 27th, and this is on Bloomberg. Dream of U.S. oil independence slams against shale costs. So the path towards U.S. energy independence, they say, is not so looking likely because the shale oil, turns out, is going to be a lot harder than it seems. Now remember the phony nightclub where the guy doesn't need to earn any money for real? Just a few of the roadblocks to energy independence. Independent producers will spend $1.50 drilling this year for every dollar they get back.
Yeah, well, this has been the economics for the oil industry for a while. It's called peak oil, and they make up for it by accumulating massive amounts of debt. So the number you just quoted there, the extra 50 cents of negative return, is made up for by increasing debt. That's why in the UK, the debt is going to be added and increased to probably 2 to 3 trillion pounds of debt for the country because they're going to engage in things like fracking. Fracking, for every £2 you put into fracking, you get maybe £1 out in terms of GDP growth. So it's a negative return. But you make up for it by increasing the country's debt, which is able to be sustained as long as Mark Carney keeps interest rates near 0%, even though he says there's a bubble. So Mark Carney, again, here we are in the Vietnam of financial fraud, and Mark Carney, you know, is down there in the jungles of securitization eating the rat meat that, of his own, you know, fraud.
Well, the point is, if the guy running the nightclub here cares not at all about making money, charges no cover to come in, charges a pound for a double vodka and Coke, you know, so your shop can't do that, right? Who are these people that can spend $1.50 to earn a dollar? Who are they laundering money for?
Well, banks who create the debt.
Exactly.
So you're making money on the debt.
Okay.
It's like the old joke. You lose a dollar for every unit you sell, but you make up on volume.
Okay, yeah. I can see the banks, but I'm saying the independent producers, this, for me, suggests
but
that there's money laundering going on from maybe the Department of Defense.
We know that they abandoned the projects. Once that these oil shale projects in California that you mentioned are been proven to be unsustainable, they just walk away and they leave the ecological disaster behind. They don't do anything about it. They pocket all the financial fees from creating the debt to put forward. It's like the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would make, let's order 5,000 tanks that make, or in France, they just ordered 2,000 trains that were delivered that were too wide for the platforms. But somebody still got the fee for those trains. I mean, they're still generating fees. It doesn't matter if it's economically sound or not. It's junk economics. That's what's running the economy in the U.S. and the U.K. Junk economics. And it's perpetrated by junk smack-using, you know, bimbos like Osborne, Cameron, Obama, you know, Janet Yellen. I mean, they're just bimbos. They don't know jack nothing about economics.
And I also think, for me personally, it seems like because they're like the money launderer who doesn't care to make any money, they're laundering money in some way for somebody. They're losing money but being paid by somebody. It might be the Department of Defense in order to have those shrieking headlines that America is going to become energy independent. We're a superpower. Watch out, Saudi Arabia. Watch out, Russia. We're coming for you. But actually, they're losing money. So they say that shale oil output drops faster than production from conventional methods. It will take 2,500 new wells a year just to sustain output of 1 million barrels a day in North Dakota's Bakken Shale, according to the Paris-based International Energy Agency. Iraq could do the same for 60. So in America, it takes 2,500 wells to produce the same that Iraq can do for 60. And yet the American population is living on wishes and knishes because they're being told by Fox News, by CNBC, by MSNBC, they're telling them that you guys are going to compete with Saudi Arabia and Russia. And they have no idea that it's the cost. They're losing 50 cents on each barrel. They're also, having to drill 2,500 slam in all sorts of chemicals, all sorts of acidification chemicals, everything to just burst apart their water supply. And yet they're not being told this. They're just being told the wishful thinking stuff.
Well, they live behind the CNN curtain.
Yeah.
You know, they live in this bubble, this hermetically sealed, delusional, self-aggrandizing nightmare called the American dream, where they can frack and drill all day long and lose money all day long, and the rest of the world's going to pay their debts. Yeah, China has been paying America's debts for 20 years, but China just did a deal with Russia, $400 billion worth of gas directly from Russia. So the world reserve currency, U.S. dollar, will give way to having oil and gas priced in something other than the U.S. dollar. So then the price of gas in America will go from $4 to $5 a gallon to $10, $12, $13 a gallon, the way it is in Europe.
Yeah.
And then America will be like, "What? How did that happen? Who do we blame for that? Who should we bomb? Because, wait a minute, didn't John McCain tell us that the price of gas would never go to $10 a gallon? John McCain, you've got to go kill people in Gaza because America's paying $10 a gallon in gas. Do your price tagging over there in Palestine. Yeah, make sense of it all, John McCain, you frickin' Fruit Loop."
So the shale oil in America, the break-even point is $80 a barrel. In Iraq, just to pump oil is at $20 a barrel. That's all they need. So it's four times more the price is needed for the U.S. to stay even. The U.S. oil industry is also due to spend $2.8 trillion by 2035 just to stay even, whereas the Middle East, for example, will spend a third less and produce three times more with that same time. So that's just running in place. It can only be done with 0% interest rates and free money. But the big news is all of these shale oil projections and all of these proclamations that America is going to be this energy independent super giant oil producer. Well, it all relies on 2/3 of shale oil reserves in America. 2/3 are in California, the Monterey shale oil reserves going from Sacramento down to LA. U.S. officials cut estimate of recoverable Monterey shale oil by 96%. Just 600.
What? Say what? Wait a minute. Did I hear? What? Can you repeat that?
This news came out on the same day of the big giant mega deal between Russia and China on the natural gas deal. So nobody noticed this. So they cut the Monterey shale oil reserves by 96%. It will produce just 600 million barrels of oil instead of the 13.7 billion barrels that a report in 2011, which was used to shout around the world that we're going to be this oil giant. Well, the Energy Agency said the earlier estimate of recoverable oil issued in 2011 by an independent firm under contract with the big government broadly assumed that the deposits in the Monterey shale formation were as easily recoverable as those found in shale formations elsewhere. But the point is, here was an independent contractor paid by the government, so they were telling them whatever wishes and conditions they wanted to hear. The story points out that the oil majors never believed this story. They knew it was bogus. They knew it was fake. So all the oil majors around the world knew it was fake. But the wishes and conditions and the misallocation of capital that happened because of this, you see in the result that they said that in Kern County, for example, there was a flurry of oil activity. Everybody went there drilling exploratory wells, looking for this fracking shale oil wells, and apparently it's produced nothing.
Well, it's an amazing, again, living behind the CNN curtain. I'm sure that the vast majority of Americans have no idea that the 2/3 of their shale oil wrapped up in this project in California, apparently they overstated it by 96%, which is to say 100%. So it's a hoax.
Yeah, it's a hoax. Yeah.
So the entire oil, shale oil project in America is a hoax. And, I mean, how is that different than the Soviet Union back in the day saying, you know, we're winning, or even the Iraq propaganda during the Iraq war. Remember, they would come out and say, you know, we're winning. And meanwhile, Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf was at the border. So here you have, you know, CNN and Obama saying we're going to be energy independent. And at the same time, it turns out that they overestimated this particular project, which is 2/3 of their share oil, by 100%. So,
yeah, they thought it was 13.7 billion barrels. It's actually 600 million, a huge overstatement. Now, the problem lies with the geology of the Monterey Shale. Unlike heavily fracked shale deposits in North Dakota and Texas, which are relatively even and layered like a cake, Monterey Shale has been folded and shattered by seismic activity, with the oil found at deeper strata.
Oh, seismic activity, you mean earthquakes?
Yes.
So here we have a bunch of earthquakes, so we're going to try to frack it, or you know, open it up by creating more of an earth. Wow, what a bunch of idiots! Well, maybe California will just fall off the left-hand side of America, and we can just forget about all those Disney movies for once and for all. I'm sick of them, actually. All right, well, we got to go, Stacey. Thanks so much.
Well, obviously, in America, wishes are conditions, and that's why they're all so fat.
I guess so.
Well, that's your Insurgent Report for Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. And we'll be back tomorrow on Thor's Day with some more good news. In the meantime, shut up. Don't talk. Don't let them in your house without a warrant. Don't go with them. Don't go down to the police station unless you're arrested. And shut up, 14-5. Yeah.
Take a trip with me in 1913 to Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, and the miners are having their big Christmas ball. I'll take you in a door and up a high stairs. Singing and dancing is heard everywhere. I'll let you shake hands with the people you see and watch the kids dance round the big Christmas tree. You ask about work and you ask about pay. They'll tell you they make less than a dollar a day. Working their copper claim, risking their lives. So it's fun to spend Christmas with children and wives. There's talking and laughing and songs in the air. And the spirit of Christmas is there everywhere. Before you know it, you're friends with us all. And you're dancing around and around in the hall. Well, a little girl sits down by the Christmas tree lights to play the piano, so you gotta keep quiet. Hear all this fun, you would not realize that the copper boss thug men are milling outside. The copper boss thugs stuck their heads in the door. One of them yelled and he screamed, "There's a fire." A lady, she hollered, "There's no such a thing. Keep on with your party, there's no such a thing." A few people rushed and it's only a few. It's just the thugs and the scabs fooling you. A man grabbed his daughter and he carried her down. But the thugs held the door and he could not get out. And then others followed, 100 or more. But most everybody remained on the floor. The gun thugs, they laughed at their murderous joke, while the children were smothered on the stairs by the door. such a terrible sight I never did see. We carried our children back up to their tree. The scabs outside still laughed at their spree. And the children that died there was 73. The piano played a slow funeral tune. And the town is lit up by a cold Christmas moon. The parents, they cried, and the miners, they moaned. See what your greed for money has done.